I'm Rico.
And I'm Jessica.
And this is the Always the Critic podcast, where a couple of friends review the latest movies, except we literally have zero qualifications to do so. Jessica, we are back after our Thanksgiving / beginning of December break.
Yeah. I mean, we've been really busy, each of us, with work, with I was busy with Tebak podcast, which is our spinoff. I've been going to the movies, so have you, and so we decided to come back with sort of an all-encompassing episode to talk about some of the bigger movies that we've watched
lately. Now, you definitely watch more movies than me during that time. I've been having a lot of overtime over the last couple weeks, and this is my choice that I've been like, you know what, the hours are there, holidays are here, a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of money
Stay
that has
busy.
To be spent.
Yeah.
So, like, I need to make sure that I recoup some of those funds with some overtime. So this is self-imposed. So I haven't watched as many movies, but the movies that I did watch, I really, really, really did enjoy.
So did I. I'll just say the ones that we're not going to be covering on my part today.
Yeah, of course.
So we're not going to be covering Priscilla, which in the previous episode, we talked about Priscilla because you watched it.
Right, exactly.
And then I watched Wish and I watched the Renaissance World Tour.
Okay.
Yes, I was in there for 3 hours watching Beyonce.
There
you
go.
It was wonderful. In general, I was like, wow. But yeah, I thought that I was a Beyonce fan. The tour doc / concert video made me think otherwise because I didn't know a ton of songs.
Yeah, that is something that I will say is that I know the hits.
Mm-hmm,
and that's really all I'm at with Beyonce.
I grew up with Beyonce,
mm-hmm.
and she was on the top charts when we were in our high school years, college years, and stuff. And then I don't know what happened. I just haven't, like, after Lemonade, I haven't really invested in listening to Beyonce, and it shows because when I was in that concert video, I was like, wow, this is amazing choreo. Oh, wow, behind the scenes, blah, blah, blah. And then they play the song, and I'm like, fuck, I don't know this song at all.
Don't know the song at all.
So that was my quick experience with Renaissance. And Wish was terrible. Like, Disney's Wish was just awful. I was upset.
Oh, how genuinely. Great for their 100th anniversary.
Genuinely upset with how bad it was.
Wow, that bad.
Yeah.
Somebody really quick. Somebody mentioned that when are we gonna stop with this whole Lin-Manuel Miranda-fication of villain songs in Disney movies?
It's so bad.
And I was just like, that's not good.
I was thinking back to two of my favorite villain songs, Poor Unfortunate Souls from Little Mermaid and Frollo's song in Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah.
With the male choir.
Those are fantastic.
Singing Mea Culpa. Like, come on.
Yeah. And we don't get stuff like that anymore.
You're kidding. The devolvement of Disney and the quality and the storytelling, the songs and everything. It's like happening in slow motion. It's bad.
I let you live here for free and I don't even charge you rent. It's like you're saying the same thing twice.
I can't.
Anyway.
All right.
So what we're going to do is we do have a movie in common that we're going to talk about first, and then we'll talk about some other movies that the other maybe hasn't watched. But before we get into that, if this is your first time listening, go ahead and subscribe to your favorite podcast app. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and many more. If you do like us, go ahead and give us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. 5 stars goes a long way for us.
Come and check us out on social media to stay up to date on our latest episodes and reviews. And if you just want to talk to us, you can. You can find us on X, formerly Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at Always Critic Pod. And lastly, if you're a fan, please consider becoming a patron. It's a great way for you to get involved and show your support. You can check out the page on patreon.com/alwayscriticpod. And here we go. Shout out to our patrons. Curtis Bale, Cindy CD, Alana, Grace, Lorna, Caitlin, Sammy, Tenmei, Michelle, Adia, Aaron, Martha, Janet, and Delphia, who's new to the Patreon.
Welcome, guys. Thank you so much for the support. We truly appreciate it.
Yes, we do.
It does mean a whole lot for sure. Now, the first movie we're going to talk about is the movie that we have in common, and that is going to be Emerald Fennell's Saltburn.
Yo!
Yo! Yes, exactly. That is the reaction it deserves. Yo! So, Jessica, what is this movie about?
A student at Oxford University finds himself drawn into the world of a charming and aristocratic classmate who invites him to his eccentric family's sprawling estate for a summer never to be forgotten.
So, yes, like I mentioned, directed and written by Emerald Fennell. This
All
movie,
of the movies that we will be talking about today are directed and written by the same person.
Yes, that is They've a been Tarantino'd. Rare treat. That is a rare treat that we get here. So this movie, it stars Barry Keoghan, Jacob Elordi, Archie Madecki, Richard E. Grant, Rosamund Pike, Carey Mulligan, and Allison Oliver.
Yeah.
Now, Jessica, how did this do with the critics and at the box office?
The box office, it's made $7.5 million domestic, which I was like, ooh, I thought it would be more. And then only $12.6 million worldwide.
I'm not surprised.
For the marketing campaign that I experienced, I thought this would at least be double.
At least double. Yeah, that's true.
So that's sad. And then, I guess we could talk about the marketing a little bit, but the Rotten Tomatoes, 72% critic score, 78% audience score. Emerald, this is a critic's consensus, Emerald Fennell's candy-coated and incisive Saltburn is a debauched jolt to the senses that will be invigorating for most.
For most, okay, is the key term there. So, okay, so let's go ahead and let's talk just general thoughts here. First, your overall sense of the movie. How did you feel about it?
I lost track of how many TikToks I saw of people going into the movie, feeling good, feeling great, and then they walk out and they were stunned. And then I came into the movie and I was like, this is going to be crazy. I was expecting real balls to the wall, no pun intended, shit going down, like NC-17. Not at all what I experienced. I thought it was a lot more tame
than
what I was expecting.
Gotcha.
But I really enjoyed it. I'm a fan of talented Mr. Ripley shit.
Yes,
and
thank
this
you.
Was right up that alley.
It was. So this is, I would say, I would like to call it a little more perverted version of the talented Mr. Ripley.
Even more perverted.
Yeah,
I think it
even more perverted. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Because
a little more sexual.
Right, because you have these like eccentric people, you know, just going about their weird lives.
Yes.
The lives of the rich and the famous, who knows. And then Barry Keoghan's character of Oliver, who is, you know, he seems so shy and timid, you know, early on in the movie. And as the movie progresses, his true nature shows.
Yes.
And it is, I would say, like, the movie is exciting to watch with him as at the lead, because there are moments, so many shots that Emerald Fennell has where, like, you can see him, like, in, you know, straight on, like, where he's sometimes leering or just looking at someone from the shadows, and some of those shots are incredible to look at. She clearly had a style and intention with this movie.
Oh, 100%. And I love hearing her talk about it, too.
Oh, yeah, for sure. She also, the aspect ratio, she made a choice for that.
Oh, yes.
Yes, this was in square, I would say, or close enough. Close enough, 4x3 or something like that.
What was the last square movie that we watched? Was it The Lighthouse?
The Lighthouse, I think. That's exactly the one that I thought, too.
And your fox. Goddamn fox.
Oh, my God.
All right.
Jacob Elordi, I thought he's great. Like, oh, my God, the thirst traps that they were posting on this man in this movie. Like you can't even control it. You were drinking water just now.
And yes, I was drinking water, and you made me, like, spill some water. So, yeah, Jacob Elordi.
That's how the movie starts.
It Well, yeah.
With a thirst trap reel that you would see like on TikTok, like just like random shots of Jacob Elordi. He is shirtless. He's like smoking. The sunlight's hitting right at the top of his head. So, like,
do we want to talk about also just changing gears? The fact that this is set in the mid 2000s.
That is true. This is set in late 2006, 2007 era England. That's where it's set, and it's set at Oxford for
I gotta be honest,
part of the movie.
It felt like it was set today.
Yes.
And I know that there's videos of Emerald Fennell talking about how much effort they put into the wardrobe and making it look authentic to 20 years ago and stuff. Look, there's some movies that just are better at that. I don't think this movie necessarily screamed mid-2000s. Other than the Livestrong bracelet, I was like, all right, like this is anytime.
Yeah.
Anytime in the
or,
last
or
years.
The random moment where they're driving in the car and they're singing Mr. Brightside.
But right.
That could be today too. Like
exactly.
Because that song has never gone away.
Iconic.
It's an iconic song. That family is hilarious.
A wreck.
To me.
What a wreck.
Richard E. Grant, Rosamund Pike, like just
Rosamund Pike
she
doing
is
the most.
Fantastic.
Oh, I love her in this.
She is so great. There's a line that she delivers that with the straightest of faces. I don't know how she did it, but I'll say it in spoilers. But yeah, this movie is.
I loved it.
Yeah, me too.
I had a great time with it. I thought I wasn't going to like it. Mm-hmm. I thought it might be too much for me. But I was like, this is just demented enough to be like good. I liked it. By the end, I was smiling ear to ear. And I don't know if that's just me and my violent little heart. I don't know.
That's the thing.
It was satisfying. In the way, it's so weird because in Talented Mr. Ripley, I'm horrified.
Yes.
That yes. he did this and that he's getting away with it, right? That in this movie, I'm like, I bet, like, let's go.
We're rooting
I'm glad
for Oliver.
Yes, I was rooting for Oliver. Why?
Why
Who
are we
I?
Rooting for Oliver? That's a great question. I mean, it's a great POV.
It's still horrifying, but don't get me
right,
wrong.
Right, it is.
But.
And I don't know if I would ever recommend this movie to friends
no,
of
never.
Mine.
No, never.
No, never.
Unless they brought up Talented Mr. Ripley.
Yes. And
themselves.
They said like, oh, I really like the Talented Mr. Ripley. And this is okay.
Be like, ooh, companion movie. Saltburn.
Saltburn. Yeah. So, yeah, there are some things that I definitely want to talk about that we have to get into spoilers for. But is there anything else that you kind of want to address or talk about before we get into spoilers?
I thought we would get more Carey Mulligan. We didn't.
She was
almost like a cameo.
Yeah, it felt like a cameo.
Yeah, for sure.
How short her appearance
was. Do you think
was.
That they will get any Oscar nods for this movie?
It has a lot of buzz. My guess, maybe somewhere in the screenwriting possibly area. You know, something like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't expect anything major, like, in terms of acting. Only maybe for Oliver, for Barry Keoghan, maybe.
Right, okay.
But we already saw his true opportunity was, you know, was it last year, 2 years ago, with the Banshees of
Inisherin?
Yeah. Sharon? Mm-hmm. He should have definitely, like, he did
He get did nominated. Get nommed, yeah.
Yeah, he got nommed. I don't know
All right.
if this
What's
one
your
will
score?
Do it. I gave this movie, like, I've been teetering between these two, but basically B+, A-.
Okay, I just gave it a B. I was like, it's a solid
okay.
B. I am
Got
not,
it.
Like, C level, like 72 and 78% for Rotten
that's
Tomatoes.
That's a little low.
I think that's a little low. I think it's a B.
Yeah, I got you. So, and then what we're going to do is we're going to talk about why you thought it was a B, why maybe I thought it was a little higher. And we're going to do that right after this.
The greatest trick.
Houston, we have a problem.
I am the father.
I see dead people.
The devil ever pulled.
Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
Was convincing the world.
You can't handle the truth.
He didn't exist.
Oh, what's in the box?
All right, we're back for spoilers for Saltburn. And so.
The bathtub.
The bathtub scene. man, I was not prepared for this. Okay, so here's one thing I will say. Emerald Fennell's shooting of these moments that feel very intimate are so well done. Like,
oh, yeah.
especially like that. Okay, so here we go. Graphic stuff in 3, 2, 1. Jacob Elordi is masturbating in a tub.
Right.
Yeah, he's in a full bathtub. Oliver is watching, you know, from the door. The door is slightly open. The lighting on Elordi and the way Emerald Fennell...
It's like a spotlight.
It's a spotlight. And the shots that she chooses, like, gets really close to, like, his cheek, his chin, and then his ear. And
it's intimate.
You see the sweat beating down off of him.
Yes.
It's super intimate, but it's so well crafted and shot.
You're like, oh, this is so beautiful. And it's just Jacob Elordi masturbating in a bathtub. But it is a luxurious space.
It is.
And I don't think it was... Well, how do I put it? It was intentional for them to put the bathtub literally in the middle of this Jack and Jill luxurious bathroom.
Right. And then comes the moment where after Elordi's done. The water's draining. And Oliver comes into the bathroom. Gets into the tub as it's still draining. And he gets down, puts his mouth at the bottom of the tub and basically starts slurping it up.
I was like, no, like you can't stop it. It's just happening on screen.
Yeah.
And it like tongue down the drain and shit like that, like through the hole. And I was like, oh, wow, this is. And I thought it was going to go more, but that was.
But that was.
That was it, really.
But that was a lot.
No, it was a lot. I mean, the tension that you could cut in the theater at that moment. Because as people were squirming in their seats.
So I was with my brother and sister watching this movie.
You were not.
Yeah, I was. And when that started happening, like, I start doing, like, one of these. Like, yes. I'm holding my arms. Yes. And, like, we're all doing that to each other.
Yes, same thing with me and Bex.
Oh, my God.
I was doing this, like...
You were crossing X's with your finger.
Yes.
I was like, no. Oh my God. Yeah, that was a wild moment in the movie.
So entertaining.
Another wild moment. There's a couple.
Right. The blood moment where he what does he do? Does he fingers the sister first and she's like, "Well, no, wait, because I'm on my period." He's like, "Oh, good thing I'm a vampire." As soon as he said I was like,
when he said that, I was like, "Oh no!"
Yeah, I couldn't handle it.
But the way it's shot, because she is filming, there's like a spotlight in the back.
It's voyeuristic. It feels very Hitchcockian.
And you see their silhouettes.
Yes.
That's the big thing.
In the fog.
In the fog.
In the mist at night.
Oh, my God. It's beautiful if you don't understand or know the context. But what he's actually doing, and then he goes down.
Uh-huh.
And when he comes back up, like, he kisses her. And, like, you see... In the silhouette, you see, like, you know, when...
Yes, like spittle like, or something.
Spittle, like, coming between from the lips, between the two of them. But you know it's not just spit in that moment. Yeah. I'm just like, whoa, this is a bold choice.
This is violent.
Yes.
That's what I thought. It's very voyeuristic. It's mm-hmm. very, like, you're not supposed to be watching this, but we are.
Right.
Camera stays on these people. Do you think they deserved it, what happens to them?
Based on what happens in the movie, no.
I don't think they deserve. Like, they're pretty... Obviously, they're elitist, yeah, and they have no... They're self-absorbed. They have no concept of, like, reality. They live in this old estate that is full of history, and they don't give a shit about it. But do they deserve to be killed off one by one by Oliver?
No.
No.
Not at all.
They don't.
No. No. Yeah, there's a sense of they deserve it that I don't understand.
I know.
That.
Because by the end you're like, all right. Yeah.
There's one dude who maybe deserves some form of like either punishment.
It's Farley.
Yeah, it's Farley, played by Archie Madekwe. Like, Farley is an asshole.
He's an asshole.
Like, from the beginning.
And he takes pleasure in...
Yes, he does.
Making Barry, making Oliver uncomfortable, making him feel lesser, making mm-hmm. him feel low class.
You'll never have this.
Yes. Enjoy like, it. Getting in his face and shit.
Yeah. It's incredibly cruel the way he speaks to Oliver.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Oliver messes with him... the scene in the bedroom, which I was like, oh, this is like it. This is
I never thought gotta this would
be
happen.
Confusing to Farley.
Oh,
but
yeah.
You know what I think it is that Farley not only enjoys it, there is like a subconscious, like almost pleasure in getting in the face of this person, treating them, belittling them, and then having that person respond. He's waiting for a response from Oliver.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. He's trying to get a rise out of him.
Yeah, he's antagonizing him. He's trying to get a rise out of Oliver, and Oliver delivers it in a different way, which right. I think Farley obviously was first
he
off
surprised.
He delivers
it back in seduction.
In seduction, exactly.
Which and is really strange.
He
and he
doesn't
confused.
Fully fight back from it.
No.
Like, no. At first he's like, what are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Oliver basically straddling him.
Yep.
Holding him down, covering yep. his mouth with one hand, and then the yep. other hand he is masturbating
yep.
him.
Yep.
So, yeah. That is...
It's a lot.
It's a lot because you... That kind of speaks to Farley's... There's a sense of he enjoys being able to belittle someone, but he also is trying to see the reaction of that person. I think that's what he wants more.
But I think there's also an attraction between Farley and Oliver.
There is. There definitely is.
In the same way that, like, back in the day, they'd be like, oh, yeah, if a boy likes you, he'll, like, bother you. And
yeah, pull your hair.
Pull your hair and shit like that. And that's kind of... feels how Farley and Oliver were behaving.
Yeah, because, and this is for the entire rich class in the movie, is that they do behave childish.
Oh, yeah.
Like, there's a stunted growth and maturity among all the people in this house that they're all kind of behaving like kids in a way. Where, you know,
which is a luxury.
I don't, right, it's a luxury. If
it's
I don't get my way
to
type of thing,
yeah.
They feel so self-entitled that I deserve whatever it is that I'm asking for, what I want. Like, for example, Carrie Mulligan's character, she moves out, and then later it's found out that she passes away. And the sister, played by Rosamund Pike, Elspeth, like, she's like, ugh. She's not even sad about it. She's just like, oh, it would be like her to make it about herself.
They're so emotionally stunted.
Yeah, they are. Completely.
That it feels, that's why you're kind of rooting for Oliver, because at least Oliver's tapped into what the fuck they're up on. Like, what, he understands them.
Right, he does. He understands what
and
kind
And they'll never,
of people.
They. It's like a form of revenge, right? Mm-hmm. That they've made me feel so badly. And they're not even trying. Like, Farley's trying, but the rest of them are not even trying.
They're not even trying. It's just naturally
natural.
Who they are.
Yeah, yeah. So it feels nice that they'd never get a handle on Oliver.
Yeah. And so we see.
Only
in the
Felix
movie,
gets close and then he dies.
And he
I
dies.
Thought that they would show the body of Felix and that it would be something heinous. Like, his head would be chopped off and that bull statue.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Would be holding his head instead of like the bronze head of whatever it is, which I'm sure there's way more symbolism in there than we even realize, but I'm not going to sit here and try and figure out what statue that's supposed to be or emulate in classical, you know, sculptures and the meaning of it. But I'm sure that that has something to do with it. But, man, I thought they gave it, like, the Shining treatment because it's, like, the maze. And
yes. Yes,
I don't know.
Did.
Like, there's something really, like, weird about mazes that I was like, oh, they have a maze on the property.
Yeah.
And the police couldn't find the body. They needed someone from the household to go take him to the center of the maze.
Oof. Yeah, that's pretty rough.
It's rough.
So, yeah. So, basically, Oliver gets his revenge. It's a weird phrase to say because I don't think they were doing anything heinous towards him or anything like that, that the family would deserve this revenge. It was just more, I think Oliver just took pleasure in being able to take down an aristocratic.
He wanted what they had.
Charming family. Yeah. He wanted
what they had. And so he took it. What I liked was he kind of killed them all in various ways that seemed appropriate to them.
Mm-hmm.
Like for Farley, the whole thing was, oh, if you're doing drugs, we don't want you in this house and whatever. At the end, he framed him for the drugs.
Yep.
So then he got kicked out. For Felix, he was drinking all the time and he literally poisoned him with alcohol.
Yep.
Like put some poison in there. And I think for the sister, they were like, oh, she's really volatile. She's really
fragile.
Unstable. And Venetia. Venetia. And then he kills her literally by putting a razor blade next to her as she's having a very emotional bath.
Yep. And then the crux of it all, I think Richard E. Grant's character, I think, just passes away.
From old age.
He probably
lasted longer. I think they said that he lasted longer than they thought.
Right. And then finally, Rosamund Pike, her character has some type of illness after she reunites with Oliver.
I don't know if he caused it.
I don't know either.
Or what?
Maybe. Because the way they framed it in that scene where he's talking and, like, you see her in the hospital bed, but they keep cutting back to, like, her signing some documents.
Right.
Which I feel like is her, like, making him
the heir
of the will. So they make it, they imply that something nefarious happened, that Oliver...
Post that, because she looks healthy there.
Right. She looks healthy all the way up to the point where we just see her in the hospital bed.
Yeah.
And I was just...
I think he did something to her,
I think so.
Maybe he, like, dropped her off the building or something.
Maybe. I'm not sure. And then
she's on life support. But him dragging the tube out of her body, I was like, oh, like, it was a jolt to my system.
Yeah, that was wild. Ooh.
I was like, ugh. Anyway, the final scene of him dancing naked through the house, that's with Murder on the Dance Floor playing. I was like, yes, you got nothing to lose. I was like, into it, bruh.
Yeah, that song got stuck in my head for a while after that movie.
Yes.
Yes. If you're Emerald Fennell, what I will
it's
say...
It's such a disrespect, right?
Oh, it is. It's completely disrespectful.
I love it.
Yeah, like you are parading around in the house of the people that you offed pretty much one by one. And you're doing it naked as well. So... I will say,
well,
Emerald Fennell, if the intention was to make something that would get you not only to jolt you, but also to get you to really think about the intentions behind people and how they, either are treated and how they respond, then yes, this was effective for sure. This was a pretty crazy movie. I don't recommend it to everyone. I know a lot of people will not like this movie. But if you are, into The Talented Mr. Ripley, is definitely the clearest of them. Where if you like...
Deception.
And
psychosexual stuff.
Yes. Then this is right up your alley.
This is right up your alley. Yeah.
The one line I wanted to say that... I just loved by Rosamund Pike. She's talking with Oliver.
Yeah.
And she was like, I was a lesbian once, but it was too wet. I love men. They're just dry.
It was also a nice little reunion between Rosamund Pike and Carey Mulligan, who are sisters in Pride and Prejudice.
Ah, yes, that is correct. That is correct.
And they've had wonderful careers since then.
They really have. Both of them.
That was a true mid-2000s movie, by the way. Was that
2006?
Yeah.
2005? Yeah, right there. So so that is the movie that we watched together, Saltburn. Now we're going to go ahead and tackle a couple movies that either Jessica watched or I watched and we'll do that right now. So I'll let Jessica start with her movies.
Sure. So
which one are you going to start with?
I'm going to start with The Boy and the Heron because I mentioned Wish earlier, which is an animated Disney feature, and The Boy and the Heron is the latest from Studio Ghibli. So here's the IMDb synopsis. After losing his mother during the war, young Mahito moves to his family's estate in the countryside. There, a series of mysterious events lead him to a secluded and ancient tower, home to a mischievous gray heron. When Mahito's new stepmother disappears, he follows the gray heron into the tower and enters a fantastic world shared by the living and the dead. As he embarks on an epic journey with the heron as his guide, Mahito must uncover the secrets of this world and the truth about himself. Also, obviously written and directed by Hayao Miyazaki. And it stars, and we watched the dubbed version. So this is the dubbed cast. Christian Bale, obviously. We have Dave Bautista as the Parakeet King. Gemma Chan as Hisako / Natsuko. We have Willem Dafoe as the Noble Pelican. Karen Fukuhara as Lady Himi. Mark Hamill as the Grand Uncle. Robert Pattinson as the Gray Heron, Florence Pugh as Kiriko, and Dan Stevens as a parakeet, and Tony Revolori as another parakeet. So quite this cast here. If you recognize these names, it's because they've done dubbing work in other Studio Ghibli movies. So it's basically a reunion, a convergence of great voices, great voice cast from before. Same thing with the Japanese cast as well.
Yeah,
it's like all these people from different movies coming together as well. Box office, it's made $12 million domestic here in the States, $97 million worldwide. I think 26 mil of that was in Japan. It's got a Rotten Tomato score of 96 and an audience score of 90. It's the critics' consensus reads, soulfully exploring thought-provoking themes through a beautifully animated lens, The Boy and the Heron is another Miyazaki masterpiece.
All right, so I have not had the pleasure of watching this yet, but right. Jessica, give us your general thoughts on the movie.
I thought it was beautifully animated. That was going to be a given, but there was so many scenes that I was like, oh, this is really stunning, and they've really outdone themselves, and it feels like the movie, like the beginning is really good and the end is really good. The middle is hella confusing, and just every Miyazaki movie, every Studio Ghibli movie is strange, okay? Like, bar none, it's going to be really strange. And this one was no different. I feel like it was one more on the stranger side. And maybe if I had more time with it, like rewatch it, I would connect with it more. But I was feeling a little bit like it was all over the place. Like it was like, oh, okay. Like he's trying to find his stepmother and he feels a certain way about his stepmother. And it is a little busted up because the dad, this is spoiler territory, but the dad, his father, basically knocks up his dead wife's sister, and that's the stepmother. So I'm like, oh, we're just keeping it in the family. So it's really like that is really icky to me, but you just kind of have to go with it. And it's his fractured relationship, not really at all with his dad, but with his mother and him grieving his mother and this whole adventure that takes place. I get that. The ending, for it being all over the place to me, the ending was like laser focused, and I was a wreck. I thought I was gonna cry because there was this moment between him and his mother. I was like, oh my god, I'm going to start crying in this theater. And I looked over at Miguel, and Miguel was like almost in tears, like literally his eyes were super glassy during the same part. I like looked at him and I was like, where did this come from? It was so emotional and poignant, and it sort of brought everything into focus, and I just thought that the movie was better for it. Like the beginning and the end of the movie are so great, but I feel like for the middle I was missing a lot of Japanese folklore, a lot of references to things that I have no concept of, like the white paper spinning like chandelier thing that was in one scene. I was like, this feels like I'm missing something because I don't have the context for it. But yeah, that was my thoughts. 90% is pretty high to me.
That's a really high percentage.
Audience score and critic score, I was like, wow, that's really high. I don't know if it should be that high. The other thing that I felt about the movie was that Hayao Miyazaki was definitely feeling some type of way about his legacy and his career, and the character of the grand uncle, you sort of feel like it's a facsimile for Hayao Miyazaki trying to find a suitable heir for his empire and trying to find someone who will take over in a meaningful way and run Studio Ghibli the way that he wants it and prolong his you know, the work that's being done there. And it was very, like, when that happened and he was, like, trying to figure out if, because the character Mahito, like, he denies it. He's like, yeah, I want to leave. I'm not going to stay here and take over this world of yours. And that felt very much autobiographical because his son, his real life son, doesn't want to take over the studio.
Right.
And he's not talented, per Hayao Miyazaki's words, not mine. So it felt a little Willy Wonka-y.
Right.
In that sense.
Who's going to take over my legacy?
Uh-huh. And in that, it felt like a highly personal film. Mm. But yeah, just all over the place. But the visuals were cool. And you're kind of just like going with the flow for most of it. That was my general thoughts.
I'm excited to check it out for sure. Because mm-hmm. I have liked his previous movies. My Neighbor Totoro. I really, truly love from Studio Ghibli. The Cat Returns.
Yeah.
Kiki's Delivery Service.
Those I love all those.
I love those movies.
Howl's Moving Castle is like my favorite. Howl's Moving Castle. All of those, like, they're strange.
Yeah. There's a strange.
You can't, like, pin them down.
But there's a warmth to them.
Right. Right.
Yes. And that's what I really enjoy.
And there's messages within the strangeness of the movie. And so that's why I feel like 90% is still really high, but my opinion might improve if I watch it again.
I see what you mean.
Maybe in a different setting too, because the theater was packed. We were in a corner. I don't know. Like, I was like, maybe I should just watch this in the comfort of my home by myself.
That's very possible. So that is your thoughts on The Boy and the Heron. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about my movie that I watched. I watched Dream Scenario, a new movie, A24.
Okay. Oh, God.
This is a movie that is directed and written by Christopher Borgli. It stars Nicolas Cage along with...
Oh, I remember watching the trailer for this. Okay.
You probably did.
I know exactly what movie you're talking about.
Okay. Also, alongside Nicolas Cage, we have Julianne Nicholson, Lily Bird, and Jessica Clement. All right, so the IMDb synopsis for this movie: a hapless family man finds his life turned upside down when millions of strangers suddenly start seeing him in their dreams. When his nighttime appearances take a nightmarish turn, Paul is forced to navigate his newfound stardom. So the movie itself is, in my head, it's a very interesting concept. Is
right.
Just a man, a professor, mild-mannered, who suddenly starts appearing in people's dreams. And it becomes a phenomenon where people just are, you know, thinking about this man. And not even thinking about him like they're trying to think about him. It's just that he just appears in the most random dreams that people
have. It's fantastical.
Exactly. It's fantastical. Just a couple of quick stats. So far, it's made 4.8 domestic, 6 million worldwide. Very small release. But it has a 92% critic score and a 68% audience score. That is a wild difference there. The critics' consensus reads, "Come to Dream Scenario for career highlight work from Nicolas Cage, and leave mulling over everything it has to say about pop culture's fickle whims."
Oh.
But the audience says they have one for this movie. "Nicolas Cage is great, and Dream Scenario starts out strong, although the ending may frustrate about as often as it entertains." So, the premise here is basically this man appears in other people's dreams. And it becomes a phenomenon because an ex-girlfriend of his finds him, reaches out to him, and is like, "Hey, you've been on my mind, but not because I've been thinking about you. It's just I had a dream where there was a car accident, and I go to help the man, and out of nowhere, you just walk into the scene
what?
And just watch us. Just, you don't do anything. And, you know, he's confounded by this because this is a man in this movie who feels there's like an inferiority complex to him where he feels like he should have done more with his life instead of just being like a college professor. Like he has dreams and aspirations of writing a book. And but every time he spoke to people early on, he would just appear in the dream and just stand there, not do anything. And that kind of bothered him. When he would hear these stories from people. But it still made him like this sensation of like, you know, the most famous man in the world, but somehow everybody's thinking about him, but nobody's met this person. And, but yes, it does take nightmarish turn because things start happening in the dreams that he is the cause.
Right.
But what happens there is now all these people point to him and blame him for it, even though he has no control.
Right. It's not his dream.
Yeah, but that's the fickle nature of what the movie's trying to say. Mm-hmm. It's like people will adore you at the beginning, you know, of fame, and they will find a way to tear you down. Mm-hmm. Like, and even if it's not something that you did,
it's not your fault. It's literally on them.
Yeah, it's on
them. They're the dreamer.
They're the dreamer, but they're blaming you for what's happening in the dream. Because, hey, you're the famous one.
It's like an intangible, like, thing.
Yeah, it truly is. And it's great to see how people react to him, you know, with these scenarios. So, like, early on, Michael Cera makes an appearance in this movie as like the head of this marketing company. Like, how can we sell you? You know, we were thinking doing something with Sprite, and, you know, like they're throwing things at him. An assistant who works for Michael Cera, like, proclaims to him that, you know, I've had like this dark fantasy with you. Basically that you're in my house. And then you come, and then you basically just take me, like, what? Sexually.
Oh, my God.
And she asks him to, like, actually live it out.
No.
Yes, and it's so uncomfortable because he doesn't want to do it. He's just like, I don't know what to do. And, yeah, it's so wild. Like, that part is, like, people whatever they're seeing in their head, they want to almost like recreate it in some way. But then it turns into, you know, victim blame, because again, he has nothing to do with it, but he's been ostracized from his own community of people.
Oh my goodness.
But
how does it end?
How it ends basically is, again, we're giving away spoilers anyway. His wife is someone who is not fully on board with the whole, like, fame of it, but she does have her own fantasy that she would love to live out, and she would love for him to be in that dream in this scenario. And here's the scenario: that she is in some type of trouble, right? And that he comes to the rescue. And the way he comes into the rescue, for some strange reason, is wearing the giant ass suit from the Talking Heads concert video, where it's David Byrne wearing that giant ass suit. So he was like, "That does it for you?" And she was like, "Yeah." Like, and this is early on in the movie. Like, you know, she's hoping that he will enter her dream. But she hasn't dreamt of him in that way. Like,
oh my gosh.
You know, he hasn't entered her dream. But then after he's been ostracized, you know, from society, they split up because things start happening between him and the community involving his daughters. Like, he's not even allowed to go to the school play because people are like, they're upset. They don't want you there. So he tries to go and unintentionally hurts someone. So then it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy of like, ugh, you're going to hurt people like the way you do in the dreams. So now at the end, you know, he's already out. He finally wrote a book, not the book he wanted. It was about the dreams, and they only released it in France because for some reason French people liked it. They liked the nightmare portion of it.
Oh my gosh, okay.
So then the book, like, is not what he wants, and he's being visited by people who are getting, like, who like this sort of thing. So he's in a down place in his life. But the final part is, like, he really wants to see his wife. So the movie introduces a mechanic at the end that I was like, whoa, this is pretty crazy. So basically they were able to figure out, like, the harness that whole entering people's dreams thing with a bracelet. And here's the funny thing is that out of nowhere an ad comes up and these influencers are like, you know, we really like going into dreams and just being able to just connect with people, you know, and maybe sell some stuff to them. And here's the thing. Noah Centineo is one of them. Amber Midthunder from... Like, it's like a bunch of people you kind of know or like that are somewhat famous. And they're like influencers who are selling this dream hopping scenario. And so when Nicolas Cage tries to do it himself because he wants to see his wife, they insert themselves into his dream. He's like, hey, man, do you want to relax? I got these new sneakers, whatever, whatever. And then another. So it's the unintended consequences of this whole dream sharing space. Now it's being sold for market. It's being sold for money. And he's so upset, like, that he can't see his wife. But finally, the final image, we see the wife is being basically burned, like, at a stake.
Oh, my God.
Hold on. There's fire surrounding her, right? And then all of a sudden, out of the woods comes Nicolas Cage in the giant-ass suit and comes and rescues her from there. And then they walk down the street together holding hands, and they're, like, face-to-face. And he just says, I wish this was real. And then... there's a scenario where in the dream, the person who's not in the dream kind of like floats away. And that's what happens with Nicolas Cage. He floats away. I was just like, damn, that really hurts. But it's a very interesting concept of a movie. Just like.
It seemed like, but I didn't know how it was going to end. Like, it seemed like it didn't have a clear resolution built into it. So I was really curious about that.
I will say that the movie is more concerned with the concept. And the
mechanics of it. Yeah, the right. concept of it, but not the mechanics of it.
Right, like how does it resolve Logistics, itself? It's yeah. more of just like looking at the daily life of the guy who this is happening to. And what are the ins and outs and the consequences of not even something that you did yourself, just what has happened to you. And then how people in the world take that and try to manufacture it, you know? So it's an interesting movie. I think it's an interesting movie to check out because Nicolas Cage is actually very good in this movie. He's really good. So check that out. That is Dream Scenario. And we will wrap it up with you, Jessica.
My movie. So I'm back with Godzilla Minus One.
I wanted to see this movie so bad.
Yes! So I watched it yesterday, right after The Boy and the Heron. I did a double feature. It was all Japan yesterday. So the IMDb synopsis. Post-war Japan is at its lowest point when a new crisis emerges in the form of a giant monster baptized in the horrific power of the atomic bomb.
That is such a... That's a bar right there.
Bro.
Baptized in the horrific power of the atomic bomb.
Wow. Directed and written by Takashi Yamazaki, it stars Minami Hamabe as Noriko, Ryunosuke Kamiki as Koichi, Sakura Ando as Sumiko, Kuranosuke Sasaki as Yoji, and Munetaka Aoki. Oh my god.
Aoki.
Oh my god. I got so tongue-tied. Aoki. Sosaku as Tachibana. I'm sorry. So Sako Tachibana is the name of the character. Anyway, there's more where that came from, but those are the main cast members. It's made $25 million domestic, $51 million worldwide.
This is a movie that I had no idea was coming out.
Bro, me neither. Me neither. And then the Rotten Tomato score, 97% critic score, 98% audience score. It is really fresh. The critics' consensus reads, with engaging human stories anchoring the action, Godzilla Minus One is one kaiju movie that remains truly compelling between the scenes of mass destruction. And do you know what? I agree with that critics' score. I agree with that critics' consensus. And it is an amazing fucking movie. I had a fantastic time watching this Godzilla movie. And I am not a big Godzilla person. I don't mind the odd kaiju movie here and there, but truly I'm not one for the Godzilla lore. The American Godzilla movies have been historically not very good. And then now they have, upon the release of Godzilla Minus One, there was the trailer for Godzilla. What is it? Godzilla versus...
It's Godzilla and Kong. Is it a versus Kong movie? No, it's not even a versus movie. They're like joining together.
They're joining up.
But it's Godzilla and Kong.
It's Godzilla and Kong, whatever. Look, I think we should just give up already. It's almost like, I don't know, France doing a Captain America movie.
Oh my God.
Like, stop. Okay?
You're not wrong.
Godzilla is a Japanese, like, it is Japanese, and they have the finger on the pulse of this character and what it means and how to present it. It is so steeped in like lore and so many other movies that have come before it. Like if you go on HBO Max and type in Godzilla, like God help you. There's like 20 movies there.
Yeah.
Every decade.
Yeah.
And this movie really does feel like a spectacle. It makes Godzilla look super fucking terrifying. I was terrified. It felt like the T-Rex breakout scene in Jurassic Park. Like, yes. There was an intro sequence of Godzilla coming ashore on this tiny island. And I was like, this is like a T-Rex breakout scene. It was terrifying. And the way that Godzilla looks and how he sounds, I was like, how did they do this with the budget that they had? How did they do this with the budget that... I was really taken aback. With the quality of the CGI and the quality of the acting and the story from a story standpoint, I was like, this is the best Godzilla story that I've seen. The humans, you're rooting for the humans. You're feeling some type of way about the history that's taken place here that is all true history surrounding this very, fantastical element of this underwater dinosaur. With an atomic breath and all this shit. Truly, it was an emotional experience. It was a movie that I will remember for a long time. And there were so many points where I was like, oh my God, what's going to happen? Like, hands on my head. Like, terrified for the people.
I can't wait to see it.
You're really gonna love it.
I can't wait because, like, I've heard so many good things. And I like when, like, these kaijus, when there's something terrifying about them.
Mm-hmm.
Godzilla because looks like Godzilla, a terrifying figure.
It is. And in all of the American movies, I think Godzilla is the hero. Like, he's fighting for good.
Eventually,
and
he becomes a hero.
On the human side. So weird. And in this movie, he's pissed.
Yeah.
Pissed at humanity, pissed at Japan. And it showed, like, he is constantly just massacring people, stomping on people, eating people, atomic breathing entire cities. And, like, it was incredible. Because on the one side, you're like, I totally understand where Godzilla's coming from. Because they're like, the bombings, they keep detonating these mines in the ocean that were put around there during World War II time. And Japan is clearing the mines out all around the islands. And they're detonating them. And I'm like, Godzilla's getting real mad. Godzilla's getting so pissed. And it just is an environmental, like, aspect to it. It's... like the Earth fighting back in another sense, and it is a product of this time. Like, Godzilla only came about like because it feels like this type of carnage.
Right. Yeah, that it, man, I can't wait to see it because
you're gonna love it.
The other aspects of like here on the American side, so I'm just gonna use the most recent Godzilla movies. Because the first one from 2014, I believe, it's Aaron Taylor Johnson and Elizabeth Olsen.
You don't, like, that's the thing about these movies is that you don't really care
about the people.
About the humans.
You don't. You really don't. They do a terrible job of getting you to care.
This movie, like, succeeds in spades with that demand, like, that need to sell you on the fact that, like, Godzilla is going to come for these people and you care about them.
That is the thing.
You're invested.
I don't think these American studios understand that. That the audience needs a connection point, because at the end of the day, it's cool to see a monster destroy stuff, but you don't connect with the monster. You connect with what the monster is affecting, who the monster is affecting. And that's a human being. If they're affecting a human being and you care about their story, then it matters. But the American movies have not done that. Like, yeah, they put like people who are recognizable in these roles, but it's just like, do I really care if Rebecca Hall like understands?
Crafting a sympathetic story that you're just like devastated if anything happens to them. That is what this movie did.
I can't wait to see it.
And I don't want to spoil it any more than I already have, like just saying in general terms, like what I felt about it and how these, what these characters mean to me, because I'm like, I really, it is such a deep human like story that is told as well. The character, let me see. Is it in the synopsis? No, it's not. Okay. So the main guy, he is going through PTSD over the war, and he has all of these conflicting feelings about cowardice.
Okay.
His own cowardice. And, you know, through it all, he finds something worth fighting for in himself and with his family. The family that he creates. It's almost like found family, too, literally. And he finds his heroism.
Gotcha. I really like that as a story.
And the strength to live.
Ooh, nice. So, yeah, I can't wait to see it. I loved it. So,
I loved Godzilla Minus One. I have no bad things to say about it. It's a 10 out of 10.
Nice. All right.
A plus.
Ooh. So our top movies of 2023 episode happening soon.
Yes, but so, I did not anticipate Godzilla Minus One being up there.
We'll see if it makes it on Jessica's top 10 list. We'll see if it makes it on my top 10 list when I finally get around to seeing it. But yeah, those are some of the movies that we have been watching over the last couple weeks. This upcoming week is going to be a busy week because we got a few movies that we got to check out. I know this upcoming week we got an early screening of The Iron Claw.
Yes, we do.
Then Wonka comes out this weekend as well. I know it's getting good reviews, which is kind of
that's crazy strange.
Also, Poor Things will finally be in a wider release.
That's another odd
Eileen
movie.
Is out as well, which I've been meaning to catch. So quite a few movies out there.
It's a busy season because the strike's over and everyone's back to work and they are putting out the movies.
And promoting them. Yeah. So we have a lot of movies to talk about for the rest of this month, and we will get to those as we go along. If you've watched any of these movies, let us know your thoughts. Go on the socials at Always Critic Pod. Let us know your thoughts on them. Did you like them? Did you hate them? Just let us know. We would love to hear from you guys. If this is your first time listening, go ahead and subscribe on your favorite podcast app. Again, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Leave those 5-star reviews on there. And if you've done all that, check out patreon.com/alwayscriticpod. Be like the rest of our supporters, and for as little as $2 a month, you can help us out and support us on the show, on this journey that we call loving movies, which is a very weird way of phrasing that. But with that said, that has been our episode. I'm Rico.
And I'm Jessica, and this has been the Always the Critic podcast.